This is the Cider Guide Podcast. I'm your host, Eric West. Each week, I sit down to chat with a personality from the wide world of cider. No boring theme music, no annoying advertisements, just engaging conversation with interesting guests. I hope you're having as much fun listening to these interviews as I am recording them. Nicole Laban of Farnham Hill Ciders in New Hampshire joins me for episode 2. Largely overshadowed by Steve Wood, her highly influential and opinionated boss, Nicole has guided the cider-making process at Farnham Hill for almost 15 years now. She and I chat about her background in fermentation, her favorite apple varieties for cider making, the Farnham Hill House style and their core products, the evolution of the cider industry in the United States, and the influence of women in cider making. Here's my conversation with Nicole Laban. Nicole, thanks for making time for me today. The first thing that I wanted to ask you is, what exactly is your official title, and does that really encompass all that you do for Farnham Hill?
Thanks for having me on, Eric. My title officially is cider maker. And it's sort of a vague title because things have shifted around over the years. When I first started, I was doing everything from being out in the field to, you know, running the pumps and filling the tanks and doing the filtration. And over time and, you know, having had two kids, it's winnowed down to the point that my specific roles are tasting and blending. And that was something that was always important in what I was doing with doing everything else, but that's really what my focus is now. And so it's kind of fun on days when I go in and actually get to wash a tank again instead of just drinking all day.
So in the past, you would have been doing things like the involved with the milling and the pressing, or was it has it always been more just the sort of the juice side of things?
Mostly the juice, some field work. I know how to prune, although I'm not terribly good at it. But as our cider production has gone up, there's just been more and more work to do actually in the cider room rather than being able to get outside. And so that was a fairly early transition. And then when I had my kids, I just wasn't in very much. And so the things that Steve really needed for me to do were to do the tasting and the blending, because I had always, you know, had a pretty big role in that. But that turned out to be the thing that I needed to really focus on. So now that's what I'm doing, and we're making enough cider that's not a full-time job, but it's coming up on it.
Yeah. When did you start it at Farnham Hill, and what sort of background does one have to become the cider maker at Farnham Hill?
I started in spring of 2000, and my background I don't actually know what sort of background you need. I had spent some time abroad and had cider in France in school. And when we moved out here in the fall of 99, at some point I tried some of the Farnham Hill cider, and that was the first cider that I thought, wow, this tastes like real cider. And then it turned out that a friend of ours knew Steve and said, oh, you've got to go talk to this guy. And I wasn't working at the time, so I was sort of looking for things to do. But I had been a brewer previously, and so I had done craft brewing, and then I worked for White Labs Yeast, which some people are familiar with, in San Diego. And when we moved out here, I was sort of at sea. And so when I started talking to Steve, he wasn't looking to hire anybody because the cider at that point was still pretty small, and I wasn't even quite sure if I was looking for a job. And so I spent a day with him where, you know, he showed me the orchards and he showed me the barrels, and then we started tasting things. And somehow at the end of the day, he had hired me and I had a job. And so
yeah.
I thought that my background of brewing and, you know, knowing the clamps and the hoses and how to run a pump and how to clean a tank, I thought that was why he hired me. And it turned out that he hired me because of my nose and my palate, and the actual physical capability turned out had nothing to do with it.
That's interesting. So were you already kind of based in this sort of Lebanon, White River Junction area? Is that where you had moved to with your family? And then from there you started looking for a position?
Yes. We had moved from San Diego. My husband got a job teaching mathematics at Dartmouth College. And so I moved out, and, you know, I had had these thoughts like, oh, you know, I'm doing beer. Is this really what I want to do? Is making alcohol, you know, contributing anything to the world? And I guess ultimately for me, the answer was yes.
Yeah. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is
How have things kind of changed since you started then in 2000? Like, has the production volume increased considerably? You talked about how your role has changed, but what has kind of changed at with Farnham Hill Cider since you first started?
The production volume has increased quite a lot. Probably the main thing that's happened is that when I started there, the cider was in production, and we had five varieties in production, but the volume wasn't very big, and at that time, the apples, the eating apples, were supporting the cider, and that has shifted in the last probably 5 years or so. You know, first it was that the cider was beginning to actually support itself, and then, you know, recently it's actually surpassed the eating apple production. And so our volumes now are sort of in the 15 to 17,000 gallon range, and it's been fairly stable the last couple of years. About 5 years ago, the main thing that happened was that our big planting of all cider fruit came into production. And so that made an enormous increase in the amount of cider apples that we had available to us, and therefore the volume of cider that we could produce from it.
Right. And that sort of leads into my next question, is that it seems like you're in the envious position of having access to all these amazing cider variety fruit, kind of based on Steve's foresight of maybe where he thought the market was going.
Yes.
Can you talk about some of those specific varieties that you like working with from the orchard?
Sure.
Anything? Yeah.
Well, probably our biggest workhorse is Dabinet, which is an English bittersweet apple. And that one has really nice tannins. It's the juice. One of the things I do is I taste and test the juice before we actually blend it for fermentation. And I would recommend that to anybody who's starting out. Getting a sense of what the apples and the juice are like is really useful. The Dabinet has this really lovely sort of strong black tea and apricot flavor. So it's almost like you mixed apricot nectar with really dark black tea. So the tannins are really apparent, but that apricot flavor and the tannin structure will actually follow through into the cider. And we use a fair bit of Ashton Bitter and Yarlington Mill. Those are also really useful. And probably one of the things that we've found helpful is that by having fairly diverse plantings, when we get a very heavy crop 1 year and then it doesn't crop very well the following year, by having something that can be a little bit of a stand-in, it helps to make the blending process of the finished cider a lot easier. So, for example, a couple of years ago, we worked with a lot more Ellis bitter than we had previously, and it turned out that although we weren't terribly familiar with it because we hadn't really had very much of it before, we really liked it. And, you know, we've been finding going back and tasting things. We're like, oh, right, this is really good. What was this? And it turns out to have been Ellis bitter. And then in terms of other apple varieties, one that we've really begun to rely on is called Wixen. And that's actually was developed as a cider apple out in California. So it's relatively recent. Very small, cheery, slightly acidic apple. And that's one that we use for a lot of acidity. It's got these amazing profiles in it. I always get lychee out of it. So the Wixen is this really great, brightly acidic. It ferments out very nearly clear because it's so acidic. We also use a lot of Aesopus Spitzenberg, which is reputed to have been Thomas Jefferson's favorite apple. It's a great heirloom. It has these really great sort of rose petal and a little bit of spice in it that I pick up. And Ashmead's Kernel, too, is one that we really like. So it's pretty well balanced. Generally, it's sort of 60%-ish bittersweet apples and then about 15% bright acidity. And that varies, of course, from blend to blend. But, you know, the rest of it is made up with the apples that are either sort of heirloom types or something that's got a little bit of nice fruity acid in it, like Golden Delicious or Golden Russet.
For the most part, do you ferment the varieties separately and then blend?
We do blending both at the press and during fermentation. So Steve is the one who is the mastermind behind blending at the press, and we've pointed out to him that if he gets hit by a bus, we're all
right.
tanked, because he hasn't really been able to articulate to the rest of us how he's making those decisions. So he blends at the press, and then we end up with different totes full of juice, and then that blending process is based partly on what we know of our history from blends that we've liked in the past, but also we're definitely going for that sort of, you know, close to 3.5 pH, so that's pretty critical for us. And those blends change throughout the season. You know, we use L-Star for our acid very early in the season because that's one of the first ones that comes in when we've got a lot of Ashton Bitter and Somerset Red Streak. And then as things move in later on, then that's when we can start putting in more of the Isop Spitzenberg and the Wixen to counteract some of the later bittersweet apple varieties like the Dabinet.
Okay. From my visits there, it seems like a lot of the cider is fermented in neutral oak. Is that true?
It's very neutral oak.
Okay.
It is so neutral that I haven't picked up any actual oak flavor or aroma. I mean, I've been there for, well, since 2000, and Steve had already had the barrels for a couple of years, and he had gotten them from a winemaker who had declared them neutral already. So this is, you know, sort of 20 years on. They
right.
do still round the tannins. They're very useful, and so that's why we continue to use them. We aren't looking for oak, so for us, as neutral as they are, is perfect.
And is there was there an intent by using the oak rather than just using stainless or some other material?
I think a lot of it was the tannin rounding. I think it was just to sort of see what it was going to contribute. The stainless steel is nice, just, you know, in terms of volume, really. And then trying to figure out sort of if size and shape makes a difference. The barrels do seem to have a shape, we think, sort of in their favor. I don't know enough quite about the dynamics of it to know what it's doing, but, you know, there are some varieties, for example, the Kingston Black. One year we were so lucky that we had enough that we could actually put it in a stainless tank to ferment it. So we did, and it came out fine, but we felt like it was missing a little something. And I've had the same feelings about, in fact, the Isop Spitzenberg, which we tend to do in the oak barrels as well. And so it's hard for me to quite articulate what the difference is in the oak, but it seems to just make the flavors a little bit more open and gives it a certain texture that's a little bit different than when it's fermented in the stainless. I mean,
a lot of
our stuff is fermented in stainless. The bulk of the volume is.
Uh-huh.
But by the time we get blended, probably in every blend, there's some amount of something that's been in oak at some point.
Well, personally, I like that sort of mystery of not knowing exactly what's going on.
The whole thing is a mystery, so that's good. I'm glad you
didn't
say that.
Well, does Farnham Hill have a house style, I guess you could say? I mean, I know you have a number of different regular releases, but is there something that sort of unites all of the different offerings that Farnham Hill has?
I would say so. I think all of our ciders, well, sparing the Dooryard, but most of our ciders are all sort of recognizable to each other. And that is based primarily on the fact that Steve really loves tannins and his wife, Louisa Spencer, really loves acid. And so for us, it's trying to find a balance of a really nice tannic structure with, you know, fruit to showcase what we've been growing in the orchard, and then a bright, clean acid to cleanse your palate towards the end so that the finish on the ciders is something that is really critical to us, to make sure that you're not left wishing that you could have a glass of something else.
Right.
So a nice, bright, clean, acidic finish is something that we like. And
light carbonation, I guess, except for the still releases, but is that something that plays a part?
It does. I mean, in truth, if we could have our druthers, we would make everything still. But you know, I like bubbles personally, so and mostly we're doing it because the market still likes bubbles. And so when we first started out, it was, for one thing, cider was alarming to people in general, but if it didn't have bubbles in it, it really threw them. They just couldn't get their heads around it.
Yeah.
So that's fortunately been changing. So we're lucky about that. So we just, you know, we want a little bit of bubble in there to make it festive. In some of the flavors, you know, when we're blending and we're thinking specifically about something that's going to be fizzed, one of the things we do is, you know, it changes your perception of the acidity and makes it seem a little bit brighter acidity. And so sometimes we think, oh, you know, are we quite there with the acid? And then we think, wait, this is going to get fizzed. Yes, it's you know, in the finished product, it will have the acidity that we're looking for.
Yeah. Can you just give us a quick walkthrough of your regular labels and just kind of explain sort of like how they differ from one another and what you're trying to achieve with each one?
Sure. Like I said, they're all sort of recognizable to each other. They're, you know, they're family. We've got the extra dry, and that one is the extra dry and the extra dry still are not always exactly the same blend. The extra dry tends to have, you know, a good solid tannic base. We want it to have a appreciable amount of fruit, and like I was saying, the bright acidity throughout it, with the fizz. The extra dry still is one that it's probably a little hard to find because we don't release very much of it, because Steve and I have decided that that's the one that we really have to make be the very best, because it has to stand on its own. There's no bubbles to hide behind. There's no sweetening to hide behind. So that one, we want that to have a nice, deep tannic base note. A lot of fruit, but not fruity,
right.
And also enough acidity to carry and have brightness, but not be overwhelming. The semi-dry.
Before you go on to that,
sure.
do you consider that to be the most difficult cider to make?
Yes.
Because of that?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
Okay.
It's I'll talk about the Dooryard in a minute, but we have made a lot of Dooryard still batches because we've got something that we don't quite think qualifies as the extra dry still.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's the hardest one to make. The semi-dry is frequently made from a similar big base as the extra dry, not always, but it has more acidity and therefore a little bit more fruitiness to go along with that, because it's back sweetened a little bit. And we like a tiny bit of sweetening that brings out the fruit. So my analogy for that is that we're sweetening it in the same way that you would salt your food. You want to bring forward the flavors, but you don't want to taste the salt. And we don't care for very sweet cider, so none of our ciders are sweet. But the semi-dry has to have enough acidity to be able to support the little bit of sugar that we add to really bring those fruit flavors forward. And the semi-dry seems to be one of the ones that's our most popular. There are people who are extremely faithful to it. And then we've got our farmhouse, and that one's got a little bit lower alcohol. It's sort of a pub style. It's a little bit more casual. It tends to have a little bit more tannin to it than the other ones do. And it's maybe not quite as brightly acidic as the others, and it's got a little bit of back sweetening to it, but not much. So it's a little bit more of an English style cider in that the tannins are a little bit more forward and the fruit is there, but it's not quite as brightly acidic. So those are the main ones that we have now, and then we've got the Dooryard, which was something that developed sort of on accident a little bit. We decided to start selling growlers. So Dooryard is what New Englanders call basically like the driveway. I had no idea. I came out from California. I was like, the where? And so, you know, if for people who have been to Poverty Lane Orchards, there's this big driveway, and then there's sort of this, you know, spot that sort of dumps you into the middle of, you know, where the barn is and where the farmhouse is and things like that. And that's the dooryard. And so the growlers were from kegs that we made from what was left in the hoses after we had transferred a tank. And so it was something that was usually sort of halfway to being a finished blend, but maybe not quite there. Like, you know, maybe we hadn't quite acidified it as much as the finished blend was going to be or something like that. And we found that people liked having things like that. And so the dooryard just sort of grew out of having cider that couldn't really be put into the boxes of our regular varieties. So it didn't want to be an extra dry, and we couldn't make it turn into a farmhouse. And so we said, okay, look, you know, people have enjoyed coming here for the growlers, so let's have something that is a little different, and we'll tell them what's different about it, and we'll, you know, we'll see how it goes. So the dooryard thing has been tricky. On every single bottle, there is a number, and that number is the batch number, and then we put up on our website the tasting description of that, and it's pretty variable. You know, they're usually recognizable to farmhouse ciders. They're not that far out of the box, but they're, you know, some of them might be much more acidic. Some of them might be much, much more tannic than what we would normally make. And they're just, they're ones that didn't quite fit with the regular labels, but that we liked. And so our determining factor for the dooryard is that it has to be something that we think is delicious and we would drink.
Is that released in kind of some of it in bottles, some of it in kegs?
Yeah.
Is that?
And so that's one of the things that we put on the website is, you know, whether it's in just kegs or in just bottles. And so it's actually started to become what is going into kegs. So it got tricky for people who would say, oh, I want kegs of semi-dry to have at the pub. And, you know, if we didn't have semi-dry that was being made, we just didn't have any to fill kegs with. And so we finally decided that the easiest thing to do was say, okay, look, we're always going to have a dooryard available. So what we're going to put in kegs is dooryard. And you'll get a number, and then you'll be able to track the description on the website and see what it is.
And so when people come to fill growlers, is the dooryard the only thing that's available to them, or can
no.
they get some of the other blends
no,
as well?
No, the growler people get a little bit of everything. In
okay.
fact, one of the we end up with this great line of people who will come if we happen to have Kingston Black in kegs that we do for growlers. And, you know, we make sure that we let people know, you know, like, okay, we're going to be doing this. And if we know ahead of time, we'll tell the people that have been coming in. But, we try to have people get on our growler email list, and, you know, that's all it's going to be, you know, it's none of this marketing stuff. And it's just to say, you know, this is the day, because it varies a little bit, particularly in the wintertime, you know, our dooryard can get really icy, and those are not good days to have people coming in and carrying around big glass jugs.
Yeah.
But it's the growlers are still the same as it ever was, where, you know, there might be a couple of kegs of extra dry that we made while we were bottling it, or there might be, a keg that's some great proportion of Wixen because we were blending it in something else and there was a little bit left in the hoses and that kind of thing. So it's still... it's a complete mishmash what you get for growlers, but usually there's at least two or three different options, and so we let people try them and then decide which one they'd like. Sometimes people blend on the spot. They'll be like, well, I kind of want half of this and half of that. And we're like, okay, sure, you can do that.
Do you find that that you've built sort of a loyal customer base over time, and are they becoming more educated about cider, and not just your ciders, I guess, but about cider in general?
They're definitely loyal. I will say that, absolutely. They are certainly more educated about our ciders. And I would say that in general, because they have tried our ciders, it makes them more willing to try other ciders. They tend to be somewhat more opinionated, I think, about those other ciders than the normal market would be. But it's neat to hear back from other people. They'll be like, oh, you know, I tried this one and I liked it. And, you know, sometimes they'll ask us if there's other varieties of cider that we like, and we'll tell them which ones, you know, we think are pretty good.
Yeah. One of the other things that I wanted to ask you about, too, is I know that when I visited, I can't remember how long ago it's been, but I had a Perry.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other sort of things that just aren't released that regularly that may not be a Dooryard release, but maybe like a single variety or Perry or something like that?
Yes. We're wrestling with that a little bit. So the Perry trees are notoriously fickle. They don't like it when it gets too cold. And so, you know, we'll get a crop maybe 2 years in a row, and then we won't hear anything from the trees for like 5 years. So to get it into bottles, it has to be really good. And so that's why we don't necessarily bottle the Kingston Black every year, because sometimes it's just a little bit too weird. I mean, it's weird anyway, but it's,
right.
it's weird and it's variable, but there's some years that we just think, you know, this isn't, we don't really like this enough. And the Perry is, we like it enough, but we're still learning about it. So we're still trying to figure out what we like and what we think is Perry that we want to put into bottles. And then, you know, there's a lot of other ones. Steve and I are having an argument just right now, in fact, about a puncheon of Ribston Pippin, which every couple of years comes out just gorgeous. It's the fruit itself, if you've ever eaten the Ribston Pippin, is very rich, and it's got this nice acidity, but it's got this great sort of sweetness along with it, and it's just full of flavor. And so I keep agitating for doing a special reserve bottling of it, but Steve has been pretty strong about sticking to his wife Louisa's line that if it's good cider, put it in a blend and make really good cider out of it.
Right.
And there's a huge amount of weight to be had on that. That's, I mean, you know, the answer to that pretty much should be, oh, right, of course. But it also turns out to be a little tricky about, you know, once you do end up with, say, 25 or 50 cases of a particular thing, then what do you do with it? Who gets it? Where does it go? And so that gets a little tricky as well. So, you know, 1 year we did Perry, and we never quite figured out where to sell it. So I think most of it just kind of got handed out to people that visited, and probably that's what you had.
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to kind of go to next, is that it seems like more and more consumers are becoming interested in things like single variety ciders and Perrys and some of the more kind of esoteric things.
Mm-hmm.
Since you started as the cider maker there, how do you perceive that the sort of cider industry has sort of changed around you, and has Farnham Hill adapted to that, or is Farnham Hill leading the way? Can you just talk about that sort of evolution of the cider industry in the U.S.?
Okay, there have been enormous changes. When we tried to get cider down into New York in the city, and we made some, you know, forays down there and into Washington, D.C. back in like 2002 and 2003. And people would walk by in the wine shops and look at you out of the corner of their eyes like you had three heads. And then, you know, it was all that they could do to not put their hand up and shield their eyes from you while they walked straight to whatever it was that they were there for.
Yeah.
The only people that I could get to stop and talk to me usually were people who were British, and they, you know, 80% of them said, oh, you know, I drank too much of that in university. I can't do cider. So
right.
It was this huge slog. People just didn't have a place in their brain to put it, because, you know, in New England, when people say cider, they mean the fresh, cloudy stuff that's in a jug that you get in the fall. In California, where I grew up, cider meant Martinelli's, which was really sweet, fizzy apple juice in the little apple jar. And so,
which you can find in pretty much any supermarket now, I think.
Exactly,
but,
right.
Yeah.
So, you know, people have these perceptions of what cider is. And so usually the only people that were actually interested in what we were doing were people that had traveled to somewhere else in the world, you know, England or France or even Spain, that still had robust cider making practices. And so they'd run into it there, and then, you know, were greatly surprised to find that there was something similar to that in the U.S. You know, I said I had a couple of kids. I wasn't there for a lot. And then we went back. I went down to New York again for the first time in, I think it was 2011. It was the first year that New York Cider Week happened. And people just loved us. I would go in and I'd say, "Hi, I'm from Farnham Hill." And, you know, sort of expecting the same kind of like, "What? Who are you?" And they're like, "Oh, Farnham Hill, we love you guys. Oh, you're so great." And I was completely flabbergasted. And so a lot of this is because, you know, throughout that time, we've been sort of slogging away trying to explain to people what cider is. Louisa Spencer has been behind quite a lot of that. She's, you know, put a lot of pavement time in. And so it's a little bit magical to me, but it's also the result of a lot of really hard work. And there's a lot more people interested in it now, and there's a lot more people that are making very good cider now, which I think is a difference. There just wasn't a lot of cider production in the United States back in, you know, the early 2000s. And the people who were making it were either very small, very regional people, or, you know, I have to admit that in the mid-90s, I drank a lot of Wider's pear cider when I lived in Seattle. And when I went back a couple of years ago and had some, I was completely aghast with myself. So there's, you know, people are beginning to realize that it's actually something really interesting and something to try. And because I came from brewing, I see a lot of parallels with the explosion in the craft brewing industry. And so, you know, first it's the little grow little. And then I feel like right now we're on that exponential growth curve, which is fantastic, but it's the same sort of thing. You know, all the big boys are getting in, they're spending a lot of money, which for us is great because they're telling a bunch of people to go drink cider and we don't have to pay to have people told that. So we think it's all good. And then at some point, the same as with any industry, I presume that there's probably going to be a shakedown and whoever's left standing are the people that make good cider that people want to drink.
Yeah, and speaking with Steve, I think he feels the same way, and I kind of trust him to see sort of the trends happening. And so I hate for that to be the case, but like having kind of been sort of a beer enthusiast myself, I do know that there have been dips in sort of the, you know, meteoric rise of craft beer. So despite the fact that there are, I don't know what it is, over 3,000 breweries now in the U.S., it's, there are a lot that have gone by the wayside too, is part of that, as part of that growth. So. Well, one thing I wanted to finish with, Nicole, is that my entry into the world of cider was actually through Diane Flynn at Foggy Ridge Cider. She's kind of my local cider maker.
She's a good person to learn from.
Yeah, I kind of felt that because I, you know, kind of learned about cider from her, and I've met, you know, other women cider makers in Virginia like Courtney Maley at Blue Bee in Richmond. I just kind of assumed that there were more women cider makers out there. Is that something that you're surprised about, that there aren't more women in cider making?
I am a little bit surprised. I think because I know Diane Flynn and because Steve Wife, Louisa, is so very involved in what we're doing, I had the perception that there were more women, and Eleanor Leger from Eden Ice Cider. But I've judged at Glencap out in Michigan for the last 3 years, and they're were not a lot of women there. And so I was realizing that there probably are not as many women in cider making as I had thought. But I also wonder if part of that perception is, you know, who the headliners are. So there are, you know, I've been a cider maker with Steve Wood for, you know, almost 15 years. And I, you know, there's probably a handful of people who know about me, which is fine with me. But what that does is that gives the perception that Steve, who, you know, co-owns the business with his wife, and his wife has been extraordinarily involved and is, you know, deeply integral to the program, you know, and me, and there's other women that work with me. I know a number of other husband and wife cider making teams. I'm thinking, you know, Dan Wilson and his wife with Slyborough. I'm wondering if that perception is just that there are probably more women involved who simply just aren't out there, you know, as visible as the men are. And, you know, that's, I suppose, a historical issue for us.
Yeah.
But that's something I'm actually curious about myself.
Well, it seems like running a small business, like a small-scale cidery, does require an entire family's effort to make it succeed. So I think I agree with you. There probably are a lot of women behind the scenes. And I think a trend that I would like to see continue is that it seems like there's a number of sort of homestead, farmstead scale type cider making, you know, people who may be interested in like organic agriculture or something like that, getting into fruit growing and cider making. And I think it'd be wonderful if we had a lot of, you know, families out there across the country being able to support themselves through cider. I think that would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Autumn Shostak at Eve Cidery is a really good example of that. She started it and her husband works with her and their company supports basically another family working with them. As well as a couple other people. And for us, there's actually two components of what you're saying, and I completely agree with you. I think that it would be great to see that. It would support more families being able to, you know, work and things together, but also what it's doing is making the kind of cider that we really appreciate, in part because it's what we're doing, which is making orchard-based cider and focusing on the fruit that's going into the cider. And for us, that's really critical, is, you know, being able to grow good fruit to make good cider and for other cider makers to be able to have access to good fruit so that they can also make good cider. And I think that that probably is also contributing to the fact that there are more and more ciders out there that are really well made.
Yeah, it's an exciting time for cider.
It
definitely
is. It really is.
Well, Nicole, thanks for speaking with me today, and thanks for making such great quality ciders there at Farnham Hill, and thanks to everyone there at Poverty Lane Orchards for doing what they've done to kind of raise public awareness and awareness of the trade about cider. Thanks so much for what you do, and thanks for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Eric. I'm happy to have been on. Thank you for having me, and cheers to everybody, and thanks for supporting cider in general.
Awesome. Thanks, Nicole.
All right. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to talk with Nicole, and I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Nicole has an amazing palate, and despite not being very well known, is one of the very best cider makers in the United States. Farnham Hill has an outstanding reputation for quality, and Nicole's cider making skill is a major reason why. For more on Poverty Lane Orchards and Farnham Hill ciders, visit their website at povertylaneorchards.com. You can also find Farnham Hill on various social media platforms, particularly Facebook, at facebook.com/farnhamhillciders. That's facebook.com/farnumhillciders. I hope you've enjoyed this second episode of the Cider Guide podcast. I'd really, really welcome your feedback. If you felt the episode was too long, too short, anything that comes to mind, even if it's just to say that you enjoyed this episode and can't wait for the next one. I'm at Cider Guide on Twitter, or you can email me directly at eric@ciderguide.com. That's eric@ciderguide.com. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join me again next week.